Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. Okay, so we were talking yesterday about the application of calming mental fabrication, mental formations, but then also one has to pay attention to the perceptions and the actual resolve or intention within the mind, so that. We had just read Majjhima 78, and it was an example of a way to calming mental fabrication caused by perception stops even the activity of right resolve, leading to a steadier state of concentration. And continue on. As for the question of how to overcome perceptions related to human society when trying to attain concentration, because that was more the internal perceptions that one was yesterday's reading was dealing with. As for the question of how to overcome perceptions related to human society when trying to attain concentration, Majjhima 121, which is the Chula Sunyata Sutta, the lesser discourse on emptiness, recommends first focusing on the perception of wilderness, and observing how it is empty of the disturbances that come with perceptions of village or human being. This perception is easiest, of course, if you actually go into the wilderness, but can also be developed in areas that you don't normally think of as wilderness, for even large cities have their wilderness aspect as well. Once you have taken pleasure, found satisfaction, settled, and indulged in the stillness that comes with the perception of wilderness, you notice if any disturbance remains. You see that there is, caused by perception, you see that there is, caused by perception, of wilderness itself. After all, in the wilderness there are dangers. And he gives an example, Anguttara 5, 77. In that sutta, the Buddha points to the dangers of of living in the forest, living in the wilderness. So one, of poisonous snakes, scorpions, that sort of thing. Two, of various illnesses that one can contract. Three, wild beasts such as tigers, bears, etc. Four, criminals, people engaged in unlawful activity. Five, malevolent ghosts and spirits. So, to abandon that disturbance, you direct the mind to a more refined perception that can act as a basis of concentration. When you have taken pleasure, found satisfaction, settled, and indulged in that perception, you observe it to see first how it is empty of the disturbances that were dependent on the perceptions it has now abandoned, and then to see if there are still any disturbances present in your state of concentration. In this way, the discourse describes the progression through the stages of concentration as a step-by-step process of increasing emptiness from disturbance. With each level, you note that you have abandoned some of the disturbances present on lower levels of concentration, but that there is still a modicum of disturbance coming from the perception that keeps you connected to the dimension forming the theme of that level of concentration. Dropping that perception, you attend to a more refined perception, and so on up the levels of concentration until you can drop all perceptions and attain total release. Although the discourse uses the earth property rather than the breath, as the initial theme of concentration, its recommendations for using earth as a theme of meditation can be applied to the breath by extrapolation. And its discussion of the formless attainments would apply directly to these stages when approached through breath meditation. So this is a quote from Majjhima 121. And further, Ananda, the monk, not attending to the perception of the dimension of the infinitude of space, not attending to the perception of the dimension of the infinitude of consciousness, attends to the singleness based on the perception of the dimension of nothingness. His mind takes pleasure, finds satisfaction, settles, and indulges in its perception of the dimension of nothingness. He discerns that whatever disturbances that would exist based on the perception of the dimension of the infinitude of space are not present. Whatever disturbances that would exist on the based on the perception of the dimension of the infinitude of consciousness are not present. There is only this modicum of disturbance, the singleness based on the perception of the dimension of nothingness. He discerns that this mode of perception is empty of the perception of the dimension of the infinitude of space. This mode of perception is empty of the perception of the dimension of the infinitude of consciousness. There is only this non-emptiness, the singleness based on the perception of the dimension of nothingness. Thus he regards it as empty of whatever is not there. Whatever remains, he discerns as present, there is this. And so this, his entry into emptiness, accords with actuality, is undistorted in meaning and pure. And further, Ananda, the monk, not attending to the perception of the dimension of the infinitude of consciousness, not attending to the perception of the dimension of nothingness, attends to the singleness based on the dimension of neither perception nor non-perception. His mind takes pleasure, finds satisfaction, settles, and indulges in the dimension of neither perception nor non-perception. What the Buddha is clearly recommending here is a direct observation of how perception fabricates the level of stress in the mind and how it can be used to calm that stress. Instead of simply replacing one perception with another, you examine how the more refined perception actually helps to empty the mind of disturbance. This approach leads to a greater insight into the process of fabrication. At the same time, it gives practice in applying the Four Noble Truths to the processes of concentration. It looks for the stress, here called disturbance, dharata in Pali, present in each level, after which it looks for the cause of stress present within the factors of concentration itself. And then it looks for ways to alleviate the stress caused by the mind's own activities. I think that Chula Sanyata Sutta is one of the best suttas that lays out the Buddha's treatment of sunyata, of emptiness, as opposed to later modes of assumption. In the sense that emptiness turns into almost a metaphysical property, domain, and the Buddha's approach is much more practical, in that sense of okay, it's empty of this, and you keep emptying. It's a process of letting go, of relinquishing, and in that way, stilling the mind. And that's also that the traditional Theravada approach of what sunyata is, or emptiness. Is an emptiness of self. Any questions? Yeah.
I had a question about abandoning the perception of being part of society, and that if one regularly shares merit and then you have this long list, it seems like you're bringing to mind all these different perceptions, and I'm wondering if sometimes it might be skillful to just shorten it to be like sharing merit with all beings.
Well, it depends, because what you're doing is it depends what you're trying to do. So in the sense of if you're shortening it in order to relinquish the perception of society and beings and that connection there, because it's creating agitation and disturbance in the mind, then yes, one would do that. But if one's doing it as an exercise in bringing up wholesome states of mind, generating that quality of punya and brightness of mind, because you're recollecting and it's actually fulfilling that function, then it's a useful exercise. You know, at some point in time it will be drawn, but it's a you have to understand the intention of the exercise that you're doing. So that and is it fulfilling that intention? Because you might make a long list, and it's like I remember Bhikkhuni, who's a disciple of Lama Zopa. No. Taller, she lived in the Bay Area. She probably still lives there. Not Tenzin Choki. You remember?
She used to come to the
master. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Anyway, I remember her saying oftentimes they'll like with Lama Zopa, they'd be careful what they'd offer him or what time they offer him something, because he would receive the offering. Then he'd start doing his dedications of merit, which would go, would go on forever. He's totally happy to be doing this. He's delighted, and he's somebody who, both the punya as well as the incredibly bright states of mind, as well as meditative accomplishments. He's quite exceptional.
Dreamy.
I knew it started with D, and it wasn't coming. Yeah, dreamy. Those are dreamy. By viewing the state of concentration as a fabrication in this way, you avoid the sort of attachment that could come from viewing the dimensions reached in concentration as metaphysical principles. For instance, when arriving at the dimension of the infinitude of consciousness, which Anguttara 10.29 identifies as the highest non-dual totality, and he doesn't give anything other than that reference. But in that, the refrain in that sutta, as it's describing the different material worlds, heavenly realms, meditative attainments, then on up to the dimension of infinitude of consciousness, and as it goes through each sort of layer or level, and it's even for such and such, whether some material thing or heavenly realm or meditative attainment, there is alteration, there is change. Seeing this, thus, the instructed noble disciple becomes disenchanted with it. Being disenchanted becomes dispassionate toward the foremost, not to speak of what is inferior. So that, because at each level it sort of seemed like seemed like the best thing at the time. But then on reflection and contemplation, so that using that doorway of anicca, of impermanence, of inconstancy, of change, alter. So that as a doorway to insight and relinquishment. Okay. For instance, when arriving at the dimension of the infinitude of consciousness, which Anguttara 10.29 identifies as the highest non-dual totality, you don't perceive it as a true self or a non-dual ground of being underlying the self and the world. Instead, you look for the stress caused by fabrication present in the experience of that dimension so that you can drop the perception causing that stress. As Majjhima 121 shows, when you follow this process to ever higher levels of refinement, you ultimately arrive at something greater than any metaphysical principle, total release from all suffering and stress. Especially these days where it's passé now, it's gone out of fashion, but there was a big buzz for a while of non-dual teachings, non-dual awareness, non-dual, and but that's where the Buddha is sort of saying, well, you want to look at that really closely, because even that is unsatisfactory. Any questions?
Metaphysical principles, is that the same as making something into a concept?
Well, yes. I mean, one can that could be part of it. That assumption of a higher reality that is solid and can be on. And then there can be kind of a reifying of that concept.
Questions of metaphysics, isn't that sort of questions of being and existence?
Yeah, questions of being and existence, yeah.
Also reminds me of the Brahmajala Sutta. Where just myriad wrong views actually come from assumptions applied to meditative experiences.
Yes, yeah. 62 kind of assumptions, and most of the metaphysical, some of them not, but most of the metaphysical assumptions the Buddha elucidates. Oh, that's the first sutta in the Dīgha Nikāya.
All exists, all does not exist. Yeah. All does not.
Yeah. It takes the philosophical underpinnings of pretty much all the existent spiritual quests of in the Buddha's time and sort of lays it out and points to its weakness. It's a bit mind-numbing. Okay, we'll move on to the third tetrad, which is the tetrad on the cittanupassana aspect of anapanasati. He trains himself, I will breathe in, sensitive to the mind. He trains himself, I will breathe out, sensitive to the mind. Or as Bhikkhu Bodhi translate, experiencing the mind, the patisamveti. 10, he trains himself, I will breathe in, gladdening the mind. He trains himself, I will breathe out, gladdening the mind. And yeah, gladdening is, I'm not sure what Vajra Bodhi uses. Abhipamoja. Pamoja is delight, and abhi is a... And that... but anyway, you get the impression. Yeah, he uses gladdening as well. So that's a good... he trains himself, I will breathe in, steadying the mind. He trains himself, I will breathe out, steadying the mind. Samodahang, which is samadhi, concentrating, settling. 12, he trains himself, I will breathe in, releasing the mind. He trains himself, I will breathe out, releasing the mind. Vimochini, let's say, releasing is a good word. Step 9 is an exercise in sensitizing yourself to the state of your mind as you try, successfully or not, to focus it on the breath. The ability to observe the mind in this way is helpful in 3 ways. As you start out, it enables you to figure out what needs to be changed to bring the mind into right concentration. Once the mind has reached a level of right concentration, it helps you to figure out how to stay settled there. And ultimately, as indicated by the passage from Majjhima 111, cited in chapter 6, which we skipped over, when concentration has been mastered, it allows you to observe the fabrications at work in right concentration, so that you can find the escape from them. And I thought I'd read that whole sutta. It's a really excellent sutta. And it's a... lovely case of the Buddha praising Sariputta. So this is the Anupada Sutta, which one by one as they occurred is how it's translated. Thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Savati in Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's Park. There he addressed the bhikkhus thus, "Bhikkhus, Venerable Sir," they replied. The Blessed One said this, "Bhikkhus, Sariputta is wise. Sariputta has great wisdom. Sariputta has wide wisdom. Sariputta has joyous wisdom. Sariputta has quick wisdom. Sariputta has keen wisdom. Sariputta has penetrative wisdom. During half a month, Bhikkhus, Sariputta gained insight into states one by one as they occurred." And the footnote on that is that the commentary explains Sariputta developed insight into states in successive order by way of the meditative attainments and the jhanas factors, as will be described. The two-week period referred to fell from the time of Venerable Sariputta's ordination under the Buddha to his attainment of arahantship while listening to the Buddha explain the comprehension of feeling to Diganaka, which is the Diganaka Sutta, Majjhima 74, which is another great sutta. Now Sariputta's insight into states one by one as they occurred was this. Here bhikkhus, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, Sariputta entered upon and abided in the first jhana, which is accompanied by applied and sustained thought, with rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. And the states in the first jhana, the applied thought, the sustained thought, the rapture, the pleasure, and the unification of mind, the contact, feeling, perception, volition, and mind, the zeal, decision, energy, mindfulness, equanimity, and attention, these states were defined by him one by one as they occurred. The footnote is the first five states in the list are the jhana factors proper of the first jhana. The following states are additional components, each performing the individual functions within the jhana. This minute analysis of mental states into their components anticipates the methodology of the Abhidhamma. And it is thus no coincidence that the name of Sariputta is so closely linked with the emergence of the Abhidhamma literature. I think it's also helpful to recognize that when you say, oh, the jhana factors are, you know, vitaka, vichara, piti, sukha, ekagata, then that's broad brush. And then the reality is there's the whole nature of the mind is that it's composed of all sorts of different component states, contact, feeling, perception, volition, mind, different applications of mind, zeal, decision, energy, mindfulness, equanimity, attention, so that all these things are present. It's not... These are not, how do you say, one's not shutting down the mind in as concentration becomes more refined. One is settling the mind so these factors can function more efficaciously. These states were defined by him one by one as they occurred. Known to him, those states arose. Known they were present. Known they disappeared. He understood thus. So indeed, these states, not having been, come into being, have been, having been, they vanish. Regarding those states, he abided unattracted, unrepelled, independent, detached, free, dissociated, with a mind rid of barriers. He understood. There is an escape beyond, and with the cultivation of that attainment, he confirmed that there is. So there's the footnotes on that. Say, all of these terms signify the temporary suppression of defilements by the power of the jhana, not the full liberation from defilements through their eradication by the highest path, which Sariputta had yet to attain. And then when it speaks of the, in the next, there is an escape beyond, with the cultivation of that attainment, he confirmed that there is, what that is pointing to, the escape beyond in this case, here is the next higher attainment, the second jhana, so that there's. Again, bhikkhus, with the stilling of applied and sustained thought, Sariputta entered and abided in the second jhana, which has self-confidence and singleness of mind, without applied and sustained thought, with rapture and pleasure born of concentration. And the states in the second jhana, the self-confidence, the rapture, the pleasure, and the unification of mind, the contact, feeling, perception, volition, and mind, the zeal, decision, energy, mindfulness, equanimity, and attention, these states were defined by him one by one as they occurred. Known to him, those states arose. Known they were present. Known they disappeared. He understood thus, in the same way, with the cultivation of that attainment, he confirmed that there's, you know, something beyond that. So it goes through the... the different attainments of jhana, the form jhanas, and then to the formless attainments, and again, bhikkhus, by completely surmounting the base of nothingness, Sariputta entered upon and abided in the base of neither perception nor non-perception. And it's interesting that here's, say, in the and the states in the base of nothingness, the perception of the base of nothingness, and the unification of mind, the contact, feeling, perception, volition, and mind, the zeal, decision, energy, mindfulness, equanimity, and attention. These states were defined by him. So this is happening in the formless attainments. That's just something that sometimes I think is easily misunderstood, that there's nothing happening, and the mind is still there, still functioning. Yeah.
I think it harkens back to the other day when we were talking about how contemplation isn't always like with thought or verbalized thinking.
Yes.
It's more reflection and knowing. Things are appearing in the knowing.
Yeah, knowing and attention are and the self-reflective nature of that. Because oftentimes that assumption is we've got to basically sort of annihilate everything and nothing, not experience things. Or things are just, even when something arises, whether, contact, feeling, perception, volition, zeal, this arises and it's seen as a disturbance as opposed to seen as a phenomena to be recognized, understood, and let go of. It's actually a big difference. So he emerged mind. He abided in the base of neither perception nor non-perception. He emerged mindful from that attainment. Having done so, and this is where the difference is. Neither perception nor non-perception is where you start to, it gets too refined to really take note of. Having done, he emerged mindful from that attainment. Having done so, he contemplated the states that had passed, ceased, and changed thus. So indeed, these states, not having been, come into being. Having been, they vanished. So that, there's a footnote on that. This indirect, introspective method must be used to contemplate the fourth immaterial attainment because this attainment, being extremely subtle, does not enter into the direct range of investigation for disciples. Apparently, only fully enlightened Buddhas are able to contemplate it directly. So. Regarding those states, he abided, unattracted, unrepelled, independent, detached, free, dissociated, with a mind rid of barriers. He understood there is an escape beyond, and with the cultivation of that attainment, he confirmed that there is. Again, bhikkhus, by completely surmounting the base of neither perception nor non-perception, Sariputta entered upon and abided in the cessation of perception and feeling, and his taints were destroyed by his seeing with wisdom. And that cessation of perception and feeling is only accessible to arhats through the destruction of the taints. He emerged mindful from that attainment. Having done so, he recalled the states that had passed, ceased, and changed thus. So indeed, these states, not having been, come into being. Having been, they vanish. Regarding those states, he abided unattracted, unrepelled, independent, detached, free, dissociated, with a mind rid of barriers. He understood there is no escape beyond. And with the cultivation of that attainment, he confirmed that there is not. And the footnote on that is, says, note the realization that there is no escape beyond the attainment of arhatship. So. Because, rightly speaking, were it to be said of anyone, he has attained mastery and perfection in noble virtue, attained mastery and perfection in noble concentration, attained mastery and perfection in noble wisdom, attained mastery and perfection in noble deliverance. It is of Sariputta indeed that, rightly speaking, this should be said. Because, rightly speaking, were it to be said of anyone, he is the son of the Blessed One, born of his breast, born of his mouth, born of the Dhamma, created by the Dhamma, an heir in the Dhamma, not an heir in material things. It is of Sariputta indeed that, rightly speaking, this should be said. Because the matchless wheel of the Dhamma set rolling by the Tathagata is kept rolling rightly by Sariputta. This is what the Blessed One said. Bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. Any questions? And I think, well, do I need to four jhana formless attainments, get to say perception, non-perception, or non-perception, do I need to get all, start worrying about all that? It's just keep remembering, okay, those states, having been, come into being, they vanish. That's something everybody can contemplate, reflect on. It's Ajahn Chah, of course. That's his mantra that he kept plugging away over the years and decades of his teaching. And maina, it's uncertain, unsure. This is unstable. It's changing. Pay attention to that. That's where that sense of being able to be unattracted, unrepelled, independent, detached, free, mind rid of barriers. That's the doorway into the Dhamma, and then recognizing, okay, what's still left? What am I still holding on to? Is there a way to get beyond this?
Interesting too. It's so clear because Sariputta didn't even get distracted, say, in the fourth jhana to develop all the psychic powers because he never developed, I guess.
Yes, that's just right. That's right. That's right.
Straight for the money.
Straight for the jackpot.
So I just find it so beautiful that he is foremost in wisdom, but then obviously, I mean, if I were sort of like thinking about it, I would say, oh, he might have been like liberated by wisdom as opposed to liberated on both sides, but uh-huh. It's a very clear indication that no, he developed the meditative attainments all the way to
yes.
The very end.
Yes, yes. Yes, actually, there are some people who sort of put this plug in because he didn't have psychic powers, and you say, why? You know, he wasn't able to meditate that well. He was just, liberated to wisdom. Well,
just because he could meditate that well, he didn't get distracted.
He just didn't get caught up in anything. It's just, didn't. Yeah.
So is it always clearly separated out that there's psychic powers and there's wisdom? Like,
not always. I mean, because the Buddha had psychic powers and he had wisdom. Mm-hmm. People like Mahamoggallana, Kassapa, Aniruddha, some of these great disciples certainly had both, but, there's also the case of, what's the name of that? I mean, it was an arahant who used the psychic powers to get that sandalwood bowl. Pindalavaja, yes. Yeah. So, and he got, kind of criticized by the Buddha quite strongly because... he used his psychic powers, but he wasn't really using his discernment, see, the implications or the broader application of that aspect of wisdom wasn't there. So he must have been somebody who was strong, samadhi, strong psychic powers, but not that same kind of wisdom, not the same kind of reflective mind.
Also, too, that comes to mind is the biography of Deepama, and the way that she dabbled with them, but then also was instructed by her teacher to leave them aside. It's a very, I guess, personal example of dynamics between wisdom and psychic powers.
Yeah.